Why did Silicon Valley Bank or SVB collapse? I know that question has been buzzing now for almost a week, and you've been wanting me to answer that also on Cut the Clutter. And you know, I explained to you why I'm diffident. I've been actually underconfident on this, partly because it's not something that I'm familiar with. It's not something I've ever followed. And also accountancy, asset, liability, balance sheets, etc., banking, all of that sounds much too complicated to me. Out of the syllabus, as I told you. But you know what? When you ask me for something and when you then defy me to do it, then I have to do it. So I have read up quite a bit. I've taken help from my colleagues. I've also spoken with a lot of well-informed people in the business of banking and the markets. And I have some answers for you. So what happened with SVB is as follows. Usually when banks fail, in India our experience is banks fail when their loans go wrong. When they give loans either for bribes or for fixing, etc., or give loans for bad projects, as happened in the era of phone banking in India, or loans are given to buddies, cronies, allegedly for kickbacks, etc., as was the case with Yes Bank. That's why so many cases are going on. And remember, I used the word allegedly very carefully. Then banks fail. That means you gave money to somebody without figuring out, without doing proper diligence on whether the money will come back or not, or whether it's a good project you're funding or not, or whether if somebody says, give me a loan to buy a house for 2 crores, right? This house is worth 2 crores, but the house is actually worth only 40 lakhs. And the intention of the guy is to take that money out and do something else, or maybe set up a project like that and inflate the project cost so your money doesn't come back. If that adds up to a critical mass, then a bank fails. That is the conventional wisdom. That's how Yes Bank had failed. That's how the PCMC Cooperative Bank had also failed. However, none of this has happened in the case of SVB. What's happened in the case of SVB is very simple. This was a booming bank, 16th largest bank in America, but it was also a bank that boomed in go-go times. Go-go times means when, particularly because of the pandemic, the US Fed and also the Federal Reserves in most Western countries and booming economies, big first world economies as they are called, or big rich economies, Western economies, they began cutting their interest rates. They cut their interest rates almost to zero, Japan also, and flooded money also in the market. So the double whammy of taking interest rates almost to zero and releasing a lot of liquidity in the markets. They knew that the pandemic had destroyed the economy and livelihoods, so they were throwing money at the problem. They were just printing and throwing money at the problem, because they know that their currency is the global reserve currency. But these things can go out of control. And what happened in their case is, because they pushed so much money in the market, that led to inflation. Now, inflation is something that hurts people, but more importantly, it hurts politicians. Because politicians may or may not get wiped out in an election because they gave their country or their voters low growth for 4 years or 5 years, in the case of America, 4 years. But they most certainly will be wiped out if they give their voters high inflation, because high inflation hurts the poor, the middle classes, the rest, and the rich and the upper crust in the richest country, even in the richest country, are too few a demographic as voters. So politicians then have to come back and kill inflation. And the only tool available to kill inflation in the short run is to raise interest rates. So suddenly what was down to almost 0% was raised 450 basis points in 1 year, that is 2022. Now what happens to a bank like SVB, or in this case, what happened to a bank called SVB? So in good days, when easy money was available and almost free money was available, then a lot of the venture capital funds took a lot of this money and invested that in the startups, mostly in tech startups all over the world, mostly in America, Silicon Valley, on the West Coast, also some in India. Now these companies got a lot of money, and that's how valuations ran out of anybody's imagination. Now all this money was coming, and these startup entrepreneurs worked on the belief that this gravy train will never stop and money will keep on coming. So whatever money they had, they put in put it in banks. In this case, because SVB had built quite a good relationship among the Silicon Valley professionals and Silicon Valley entrepreneurs and startup people and venture capital companies, that a lot of these deposits start coming to them. So SVB became flush with deposits. Of these also, most of the deposits had come from large depositors. If you look at SVB, then at the end of 2022, it had a total deposit base of 189 billion BI, billion dollars. The interesting factoid there is that of the 189 billion dollars, 157 billion dollars, that is 83% of their total deposits came from just 37,000 accounts. And the important point is that all these 37,000 accounts held deposits of more than $2.5 lakh. Why is that figure important? Because the US FDIC, which is the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, only insures deposits up to 2.5 lakh value. That's now become academic because now the US government has said that all deposits will be protected. Joe Biden has also said, and Janet Yellen, that not a cent of taxpayers' money will be used. So how they will use it, I'm not quite sure, but obviously the bank has some assets. Bank also has money in bonds, etc. So they will sell all the assets and pay their depositors if they want their money back, and they'll find other mechanisms also in the course of time. Some buyer will be found for the bank as well. Nevertheless, this was the state of the bank, say, at the end of 2022. Then what happened? Then, while everybody thought the gravy train will not stop, like oil trains, this gravy train also stopped. And then the startup industry ran into what is now being described as a funding winter, which means suddenly now, because interest rates had gone up, easy money wasn't available to venture capital funds. That's the reason I described that as the go-go period. That was the go-go period. Go-go period was over much too suddenly. So venture capital funds didn't have more money to give to their startups. Startups now, because they were plowing money into the market, they were building market share, they had to start withdrawing their deposits to spend their money. As they began withdrawing their deposits, the bank realized, SVB realized, that they did not have so much liquidity available to them so they could keep on repaying these deposits quickly. Because what they had done was, when they had got these deposits, that was a period when they were not able to lend very much because interest rates were so low. It wasn't possible to lend at that point. There were not enough borrowers. And in the startup crowd, nobody wanted to borrow at that point, because why would you borrow and pay interest when you can get venture capital funds for free, at least interest-free? You give equity, but there is no interest cost. So the bank, because they were getting these deposits, banks start buying corporate bonds, also some complex mortgage-backed bonds, also long-term government treasury, etc., etc. So they got locked into a lot of these bonds for their investments, because what is a bank? Bank is a lender, right? You give money to a bank, a depositor gives money to a bank, bank then has to lend to somebody, because bank has to give some interest to the depositor, to the lender. The bank cannot sit on that cash. The bank has to lend it at a rate which is higher and sufficiently higher from what they are paying the depositor, sufficiently higher to pay for the bank employees' salaries, their bonuses, also their shareholders' dividends, and also to create reserves and for future investments and growth, etc., etc. That mismatch now built up. And how did that happen? That happened because bond prices began to fall. Why do bond prices fall? That's a fascinating story, because normally, to my simplistic layman's mind, I would think, oh, if on my bond interest rate has gone up, very good, the value of my bond will go up. Exactly the opposite happens. Once you buy into a bond with a fixed interest rate, not a variable interest rate, most bonds do not come with variable interest rates, even Indian government bonds. Right now, there is the bond season in India, right? 31st March is coming in and bonds are in fashion. All the mutual fund houses are now launching these bond funds based on government securities, government bonds, because they get you very good interest rates now. Interest rates are high right now. There is total safety because it's sovereign guarantee. There is also maturity in 6 years, 3 years, 10 years, like that. What not all fund managers will tell you, but good fund managers will tell you, and if you are smart, you should ask that, is that when you buy a bond, you carry a mark-to-market risk, which means these bonds are traded on the market. Today, you may buy a bond, say, giving 7%, 6% interest. If next year interest rates go up to 8%, 9%, at that point, the value of the bond will go down in the market. That's a reality which is tough for us lay people to understand. But I did read up some of it on a website called the balancemoney.com, and it's an article by Ben Luthi. So thank you, Ben Luthi, who has simplified why this phenomenon takes place, why this unique phenomenon or this sort of counterintuitive phenomenon takes place, that when interest rates go up on the bonds, the value of your bonds comes down. There is an inverse relationship between interest rates and bond prices. When interest rates come down, the value of a bond goes up. So it is very simple. Today you may buy a bond, say for 1,000 rupees, as SVB did, right? Because they had all this spare cash, they bought bonds, corporate bonds, government bonds, mortgage-backed securities, etc., but essentially bonds at a particular interest rate. But after that, the interest rate went up, and as the interest rate went up, the value of their bonds or their investments crashed or went down rapidly. So let me explain to you, how does that happen? Suppose you buy a bond for 1,000 rupees now. Today, you are told that the interest rate, and this is the exact example that the balancemoney.com has used. Today, supposedly, you are told the interest rate is 3%. 3% payable every 6 months. So every 6 months, you will get 15 rupees. So 15 plus 15, 30 rupees for the first year. By next year, interest rates go up. Interest rates go up to 4%. Now, interest rates have gone up to 4%, and you go out to sell your bond in the market if you really have to, right? If you have to sell that bond in the market would say, look, why would I buy your bond, which only gives me 3%, because bond issuer in your case cannot now increase interest rates, right? This is a fixed rate. So why should I buy a bond that gives me only 3% yield? So I will buy the bond from you if I still get at least 4% yield on this. So if you then sell your bond at 4% yield, which is the current interest rate, as interest rate has gone up, then the value of that bond comes down to 925 rupees 4 paisa. This is the exact calculation that I take from balancemoney.com, right? So you can trust this calculation. If I had calculated, I would have been very worried because I get those things wrong. So if the interest rate had gone from 3% to 4%, the 1,000 rupee bond would have gone down to 925.04. That's quite a sizable loss. If it had gone up to 5%, then the 1,000 rupee bond will go down to 865.47. That's a very sizable loss on your bond, right? Yet again, if the interest rate had doubled, say to 6%, then your 1,000 rupee bond would go to 793.70. What this means is that now, if you go out to the market to sell your bond, and the buyer wants 6% yield, which the buyer will get if the buyer goes to the market and buys a new bond anyway, right? Then that 6% yield will only come if the buyer buys your bond for 793.70, right? Because calculation of interest on your bond is only at 3% interest rate. So that is what happens, and that is why there is an inverse relationship. Once again, to simplify it again, to further simplify it, somebody might have sold you a bond which gives you 3% interest, a 1,000 rupee bond. Next year, somebody comes with a bond which gives you 4% interest. Then your bond cannot compete in that market. To compete in that market, you have to reduce the price of your bond, or the market will reduce the price of your bond. You don't determine it, the market determines it. The only thing you can determine it, whether you want to sell that bond at a loss or not. Now, usually you would say, no, I don't want to sell it, but God forbid there is an emergency in your family. God forbid something else goes wrong. Or in case of a bank, in case of SVB in this case, more people come to seek their deposits back than you have liquidity available. You have no choice but to go to the market and sell your bonds. When you sell your bonds, then you make a loss. When you make a loss, your shareholders make a note of it. And then word spreads that more and more people are coming to withdraw their deposits. And as they come to withdraw their deposits, you will need to sell more of your bonds. And as you sell more of your bonds, you will make losses. And at some point, you will go bankrupt. At that point, what is the option available to you? Just for clarity, let me also tell you that that inverse relationship in bond prices and interest rates applies on the other side also. So if you buy a bond, say, at 3% rate, next year it goes down to 2%, next year 1%, the value of your bond goes up. So once again, I will give you, because not everything, markets are fair, not everything works negatively. So again, from the same data from the balancemoney.com, if the rate from 3% goes to 2%, then your 1,000 rupee bond becomes 1,081.99 worth. If the rate goes down to 1%, then your 1,000 rupee bond goes up to 1,171.73. So once again, a lot of people who might be investing in bond funds right now in India or anywhere in the world might be thinking that, look, today the rates are high because all our feds, all our central banks are fighting inflation. But tomorrow, inflation will ultimately come to control and interest will come down to their normal average levels. When that happens, my bond prices will go up. But once again, there is no guarantee on this. You are carrying market risk. In this case, it's a bank that was carrying too much market risk, and that is what made the bank go bankrupt. And that's what made the bank fail. It's not as if the bank gave out loans to wrong people or there was corruption in giving out those loans and kickbacks or allegations of kickbacks, etc., etc. It's not as if people or enterprises the bank lent money to never paid back, so NPA is built up. It is not a case like that. It's a case of the bank having invested too much in long-term investments, not anticipating that they might come under pressure of giving out a lot of liquidity very quickly. And because that money wasn't available, they had to sell their long-term investments. In selling that long-term investments, they made losses. So we talk about Black Wednesday, right? That's a favorite expression in the stock markets in particular. Black Wednesday happened in this case because that is when SVB disclosed to the markets that they had sold some of their bonds and investments and had taken a loss of $1.8 billion. Now, it was a sizable loss, but it was also a scary loss because the market anticipated that in the very beginning now, if they have done this, because a lot of people are asking for their deposits back, right? If that happens, they will need to sell more bonds and suffer more losses. To cover for that, the bank in panic went out to raise some equity. Because what happens when a business is failing, when you have a liquidity crunch, you go and raise equity. You sell your shares and say, look, I am selling my shares, I am raising the money, so I am reducing my liabilities. What is Adani doing right now? Post Hindenburg, they've come under stress, and the stress was about their having too much debt. So what have they been doing since then? They've been selling their equity in various companies. The last company that they listed where they said they will sell about 4-5% of their shareholding was Gujarat Ambuja. And once again, the objective was to sell your equity and repay your debt. So you need equity to repay debt or equity to stabilize your company, which is exactly what SVB tried to do. They went with Goldman Sachs and General Atlantic, but this was a very clumsy, half-hearted attempt. They had suffered a loss of $1.8 billion. They went to raise $2.25 billion of equity. Nobody in the market was convinced. It's a bit like if your boat is leaking in 20 places, and impression grows that the hull of your boat is really made of very weak stuff, and soon enough, more and more of these holes will appear, and you raise money or you raise the cement or whatever adhesive only to fill one hole. Or then you say, okay, I've got this band-aid or this plaster, I will stick it on one hole, market will not be convinced. So that's what they tried to do. They had a big existential crisis and they tried to address it by going out and getting a band-aid. The market didn't buy it. That's why the next morning when the markets opened, their share price collapsed by 60%. So Black Wednesday, Blacker Thursday, and then the Blackest Friday, because by that day, that bank was over, the bank was finished. Now the question arises, which I'm sure a lot of you are asking, what happened to all the prudential norms? What happened to all the regulations and regulators in this case? How come nobody figured out what was happening? Now, I get wisdom about this from an article I've read from Daniel Davis. Daniel Davis is a former banker who's also author of a book called Lying for Money. Now, I'm sharing that article with you with the description, so please read that article. So he tells you in this article, in this wonderful analysis, that after the global financial crisis of 2007-2008, major economies, leaders of major economies got together to brainstorm on what can they do, what kind of regulations can be built now so that such a crisis does not happen in global financial system. Because now banks were interlinked. Most banks had international operations. One bank failing someplace could have a domino effect in 50 other places. So now the world needed regulations that transcended national boundaries. And that's how a set of regulations called Basel III came in. Basel III, because Basel is the place in Switzerland where this was negotiated and finalized. Now, Basel III laid down certain conditions and regulations over the banking system. As it was decided to only apply mandatorily to banks of a certain size, obviously a large size and banks with international operations, it was left at the discretion of the countries in terms of who else did they want to apply this to. So very conservative system like India, our system applied it to all the banks. For a while, cooperative banks were not in that net, or they were below that radar screen, but after the PCMC disaster, even that hole was also covered. But in America, Davies explains, there is a very strong lobby of banks which believe in borrow short, lend long, because you count on low interest rates being there forever. And they said that unless you are a bank of a certain size, you should not be exposed to these regulations. And he shows us a para from the filings by SVB, and I will share that para with you on the screen, that says that, look, we are still $75 billion below that threshold. So we are not covered by these regulations. And what are these regulations? They are called LCR and NSFR regulations. I will explain that to you in the next 2 minutes. LCR is liquidity coverage ratio. As the name indicates, it means if you have demand for liquidity, if your depositors come and say, mujhe itna paisa do, give me this money, do you have it readily available with you? So basically, you have to make an anticipation, a rough and ready, but a generous anticipation, not a conservative anticipation, a generous anticipation of how much money may be demanded from you in the next 30 days, for your next 30 days survival. Now, you have to then calculate in an exaggerated manner. You can't just calculate it in a tight manner, because this is about your survival and security. And you have to then provide for easily available liquidity for that. So to use more technical language, I used simple language. More technical language, ratio of high quality liquid assets available, that is ratio of high quality liquid assets, jo aaj aap pay kar sakte hain, which you can pay out today if you are called upon to, compared to rough and ready estimate of cash outflows you might face over the next 30 days if your wholesale funding dried up and if some of your corporate and retail deposits ran. So next 30 days, okay, my corporate depositors can come and ask for money, I have to give it back to them, and maybe over the next 30 days my fresh deposits may not come in. If all of that happens, do I have enough money available on tap so I don't get into a crisis? That's one. So 30 days is the survival horizon. So that is LCR, or liquidity coverage ratio. Name is easier to understand. The next one is a bit tougher, net stable funding ratio. What net stable funding ratio means, that while assets and liabilities will always match, or should always match, but liquidity risk should be provided for. That you may have assets to match your liabilities, right? But companies don't sink because they make losses. Okay, if they make losses forever, they will sink eventually. But companies sink when they have a liquidity problem, when they run out of cash flows. That is when companies sink. So again, I'm putting it very simply, that you may have enough assets to match your liabilities, but people to whom you owe these liabilities, if too many of them come to you to ask for money, do you have then the liquidity to give it to them easily, or will you then have to go out in the market and sell your assets, right? That is net stable funding ratio. So to provide stability to your system, you should have that easy available liquidity. So if you don't have that liquidity available to you, what choice do you have? You have to go to the market and sell the assets that you have. You may have to sell a house if you're an individual. You may have to sell a house when the markets are really low, or once the market knows that you really have to sell this house this week because you owe money to somebody who's sitting at your door, then the market also knows that you are carrying out what is called a distress sale. So what for an individual might be the distress sale of a car or jewelry or an heirloom or a house, for a bank is distress sale of its bonds, its long-term bonds at a time when bond prices are low, because your depositors are at your door and you have to pay them the money, which is exactly what happened with SVB. And the reason it happened in this case is because the bank was not covered by these Basel III regulations. And the only reason it wasn't covered by these regulations is purely an America problem. Because in the American system, because of lobbying pressures, they allowed banks below a certain size to stay out of these regulations. Because if these regulations were followed, then this SVB disaster would not have taken place.